Hello, sword people. Welcome to the Sword Guy podcast. This is your host, Dr. Guy Windsor, consulting swordsman, teacher, and writer. Join me for interviews with historical martial arts instructors and experts from a wide range of related disciplines as we discuss swords, history, training, and bringing the joy of historical martial arts into our modern lives. This is episode 179 of the show, and it's Thursday, February the 15th, as I record this. I'm off to Helsinki today, and I'm teaching on Friday evening and all day Saturday, which is a pole arms and armor seminar at the Sal in Helsinki, which is going to be super fun to be sort of back home. And on Monday, I will also be shooting footage for a VR project. If you're on my mailing list, you will have heard all about the VR project. And yes, that email generated an awful lot of enthusiasm and excitement. So hopefully this project will do well. I should point out that I am not managing this project. I am a paid consultant on the project, so it is not me producing it, so I have no control over what they produce exactly and what format is in and whatnot. But I will do my best to make sure your interests are taken care of. I should also mention that the proof of From Medieval Manuscript to Modern Practice, the Wrestling Techniques of Fiore de Liberi is back from the printers and it's looking pretty spiffy. I have one small fix to get for the hardback cover and then it will be out in the world. So you should expect that in early March. Now, I better wrap up this intro because I've got to go and pack for Helsinki. Let's get on with the interview. I'm here today with Eleanor Wilkinson-Keys, who is Assistant Curator of Arms and Armour at the Royal Armouries Museum in Leeds. She has an MA in Medieval Studies from the University of Leeds and works with the European Armour and Edge Weapons Collections, which makes us all extremely jealous, and the Asian and African Collection, which also makes us extremely jealous. She works there with Natasha Bennett, who you may recall from episode 82. So, without further ado, Ellie, welcome to the show.
Hello, hi. Thank you so much for having me. It's very exciting.
It's lovely to meet you. So I ask everyone this, whereabouts in the world are you?
So I'm guessing Leeds. Yes, so I am here at the museum, the Royal Armouries Museum in Leeds, in West Yorkshire. And if you're not familiar with the Shires of the UK, anybody listening, we're up in north.
Excellent. So sort of about 4 hours south of Edinburgh and about 4 hours north of my house.
Oh, right. So perfectly in the middle of those. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I did, when we moved to the UK, I did sort of quietly suggest that Leeds might be a good choice because there might be a certain museum I might want to visit occasionally. But there were unfortunate family circumstances that made that an impractical choice.
Right. Yeah. No, I feel very lucky that the Armouries has been on my doorstep from childhood. So
you're from Leeds?
I'm from a sort of Wakefield district, so okay. Leeds is not too far. And I first visited the Armouries in 2005.
All right.
I actually have the daily sheet here with me that I have saved from the 1st of September 2005, my first visit when my dad brought me.
Oh, actually, you must have been a kid.
Yes, I was 15.
Okay.
Yeah.
And had no idea that you were going to be spending your working life.
Yeah, absolutely. That no idea at that time that I was interested in this subject and had always been interested in history, but yeah, I would never have guessed looking back on that day out with my dad that I was going to be working here and just living the dream.
So was it that day out that sort of made you think arms and armour?
Well, I feel bad for saying no, it wasn't that day out.
That's okay.
It probably contributed, but I didn't really, I consider myself quite late to the arms and armour party, really.
Okay.
I didn't really become interested in this subject, or I should probably say I didn't really engage with this subject until I was doing my master's at Leeds.
Oh, really?
So, yes, yeah. So, I've always been interested in history, but my degree was in English and linguistics. And then I decided to do the Masters at Leeds, really great course. And in the second year, because I was doing it part-time, there was a module that was run here at the Armouries on medieval tournament. And it was run by Dr. Alan Murray, who is the senior lecturer in medieval studies at the University of Leeds. And Dr. Karen Watts, who at the time was the senior curator of armour and art here at the museum, and who is now a curator emeritus. And they sort of ran this module here at the museum. And in one of the seminars, that was sort of my first detailed look at sort of European martial culture, anything like that, certainly arms and armour. And in one of the seminars, Dr. Watts brought out a jousting helmet, and okay. For us all to, you know, to have a go at handling, to really interrogate the object. And that was the first time I had really engaged with a historical object properly. And it was a real sort of, it sounds it's such a cliche, but it was a real zing moment for me where I thought, oh wow, okay, I get it now. I see why people like this. So yeah, it was amazing. A great
course.
There's
nothing like handling an original. It's just, it's magic.
Absolutely not. And just the whole kind of 360 degrees dynamic experience of being able to look at an object face to face to see how heavy it is, to look at how the
pick it up
work.
And handle it. And, yeah.
I mean, you'll know all about that, and your students and things, but it's completely different. Looking at objects in cases is great, but being able to really touch and feel and look at it is just completely different. And that was the moment that I thought, okay, this is an interesting area.
Yeah. I mean, in 2006, when I got married, the day before the wedding, because I had friends coming over from Europe and America and places for the wedding, and most of them are like sword people. So at that time, David Edge was curator at the Wallace Collection in London. Mm. And he very kindly arranged a weapons handling session for my guests. And so about eight of us went into a little room in the back of the Wallace Collection, and David had brought out a bunch of really cool swords. Mm. And yeah, we just like geeked out for a couple of hours going, oh, you got to try this one. It's amazing.
Absolutely. It really does. Yeah. And I love doing handling sessions, particularly with people from the historical martial arts world, because I don't sort of do that. So I'm not always looking at arms and armor from the perspective of wearing it or using it or fighting with it. So it's really interesting to see, to discuss with other people who, you know, they pick up the sword and they know how this would feel to use it. And that's really interesting as well.
So you did an MA in medieval studies from University of Leeds. Did that involve like museum training or?
No. So that was medieval studies. The only sort of engagement with museums more formally at that point was the module here at the Armouries. And then immediately after that class, the class with the jousting helmet, I applied to do an internship here that was being advertised at the Armouries, and happily was successful. And so I worked closely with Dr. Watts on an internship, and that was the first look at museums and how museums work and what's involved in a curatorial element. So it was exciting but also daunting, because on the one hand I'd kind of, you know, figured out, oh okay, this is something I'd really like to do, I'd like to go into curatorial work, but at the same time, how do you get into that? And I'd been spoiled as well, because you know, having the internship with Dr. Watts and having the Armouries close to home, I didn't want to work anywhere else.
I actually went
to work for Wakefield Council, my local council, at Pontefract Castle, and I managed a volunteer scheme there. Absolutely loved it, and that really gave me an insight into working a career in museums and the sort of more broad view of what is involved in these kind of institutions and heritage sites. And I worked there for a few years. I went on to run the volunteer scheme across Wakefield Council's other heritage sites.
There?
So I managed volunteers. So I was really heavily involved in engaging local people in caring for the castle, in getting involved in activities, event days, anything that was that essentially facilitated members of the public interpreting and engaging and enjoying Pontefract Castle. So, and then later it was across the other heritage sites that are in the care of Wakefield Council. So it was a really exciting role. I absolutely loved it. I have made a very good friend there, my previous manager, Ian Downs, who is senior heritage officer there, and his enthusiasm, both his enthusiasm and Karen Watts's enthusiasm for this subject area and history generally, because Ian is really interested in local history and Pontefract Castle, Sandal Castle. It's so exciting to hear somebody talk about something that they're interested in. And both of them, actually, and I think this is maybe why I stuck with trying to get into this, is that both of them made me feel that not only was this subject exciting, but they were excited that I was excited by it. So
right,
and that I think that's really special, to feel like you know you're welcome in the group.
It does make a big difference.
Yeah,
it really does. Yeah. So is that why you went and did the MA? Or
so I did the MA mainly because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I'm happy to admit that I was the teenager who flitted through wanting to be a vet, wanting to be a fashion designer, wanting to be an air traffic controller. Okay.
Air traffic controller.
Oh, I wanted to be all sorts.
Why air traffic controller?
Well, as a teenager, I was an air cadet, so that's where.
Oh, right. So you flew in planes?
Sort of. I mean, you can have the controls for a minute, but it's,
sort of. Regular listeners to the show will know this, and clearly you don't. I am nuts about flying planes. I've got about 33 hours of flying training so far, including about 10 solo. So I've actually been talking to air traffic control. So I'm like, I understand the attraction of being in the plane, flying the plane. But the thing I always liked the absolute least was talking to air traffic control, because it always made me really, really nervous.
Yeah. So I think that came about because at one point I wanted to be a helicopter pilot. But I have really poor eyesight. So the next best thing I guess I decided would be to be air traffic control.
if you're a private pilot, you as long as you're wearing glasses, you're fine.
Yeah. Maybe I'll take that up sometime.
Okay. Yeah. What actually did you do in your medieval studies, MA?
So I did the module in medieval tournaments. Mm-hmm. I took medieval Latin. I did research modules. My thesis was on jousting. It was very much a really good look at medieval studies, but I was able to focus and hone in on more arms and armor related material. Okay.
So what was your thesis on jousting about? I mean, obviously it was about jousting, but what particular element?
Yeah, it was very introductory, because I was doing the MA part-time and I'd done it over 2 years, and I'd done quite a lengthy Latin module. My thesis was only quite a short, compared to other master's students, it was only quite short. So I didn't really have the space to really get into it, if you like. So it was very much, but it was still useful because it's such a huge, topic. It was great to just be able to give myself an overview of it. So it was very much an introduction.
Like an overview of what jousting is, how it would fit in the culture.
I'm particularly interested in sort of later jousting, so 15th century jousting.
That's when they get the really good kit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's when you get all the weird and wonderful, spectacular things happening. So,
So, is this where your interest in horse armor comes from?
Yes. So it definitely stems from an initial interest in tournament and particularly jousting. So, and there's not a lot really that's more impressive to me than a vision of a charging fully armored knight on a fully armored horse. I think it's a really
it's probably best described as a trouser filling experience.
But yes, that's where that came from. And as part of looking at jousting and tournament, I became interested in armor as a sort of performance of self. So very much wrapped up in identity and the presentation of self on the tournament field and the battlefield. And horse armor is a big part of that. In records of tournaments, we can read about you know, the jousts and things that were happening, but often they have really detailed descriptions of what horses are wearing and what decorations are on this horse armor and how this horse armor can contribute to a knight's or a competitor's identity on the battlefield, on the tournament field. So that's I just find that really interesting. And of course, it's the perfect surface. I mean, horse armor is huge, so it's the perfect canvas to, you know, to play with, and they very much did. And I think that's why I'm interested.
It serves a practical purpose.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So how effective do you think it was?
It's such a great question. And I think you're actually the first person to ever ask me how defensive horse armor was.
this is the thing that, most modern academics, and frankly, it's one of the reasons why I didn't spend much time in university after I graduated, are interested in like the social side of things and the presentation of self side of things. And I'm interested in the fighting side of things, right? Like the performance side. Like, okay, so why am I wearing this piece of armor? Well, because it means that I don't have to worry about that particular kind of attack.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So, not that the other stuff isn't important. It's just my focus is entirely on hitting people, basically, and teaching other people how to hit people. So, you know, you've had an extraordinary opportunity to study horse armor. So how, and you've also looked at the armor that people wear. So how defensively effective do you think it was?
So I definitely think it had successful defensive properties. So short answer was yes, it was good.
It actually worked.
It did work.
Surprise.
Yeah. And generally speaking, horse armor seems to, you know, it follows the same kind of developments that armor for the man is. The lines that's going on, which makes perfect sense. So, for example, by the time you have full plate armor, that's also when we're seeing full steel horse bards. So, you know, it's the same technology.
For the non-specialist, what is a bard?
So a bard is a steel, a full steel kit, if you like, protective equipment for a horse. So that
So it's a generic term for the whole thing?
Yes.
Not a particular piece of it, okay?
No, so that's a sort of umbrella term for horse armour, steel horse armour. And
so if a horse is barded, it's like a man being armoured?
Yes, yeah.
Fine.
And the horses would wear sort of some of or all of various different components, and that consisted of a chaffron, which would protect the horse's head, a petral, which would cover the chest, flanchards, which protected the sides of the body, a crupper, which protected the horse's rump, and you also have additional plates like a crinet protecting the neck, a pole plate at the top of the head. You could also have steel steel rein protectors, saddle steels as well. So there's a lot of pieces of equipment that horses are being dressed in to protect them, and they are defensive. But what the thing to note is that, like armor with the man, it's still very much dependent on the circumstances of the combat. So, right. You know, a horse can be fully armored, but that's not going to protect it against a row of pikes necessarily.
Sure. And also, the horse doesn't know that the horse is armored.
That's a really interesting question. Yeah. Well,
I've ridden enough to think that the horse is not aware that the reason it's got these bits of metal is to stop spears getting through. So it sees a spear, it will react to it the same way.
Absolutely.
In or out of armor, I would guess. Whereas a person understands they're wearing the armor, and I've done some stuff in armor, and you know, you learn what can hurt you and what can't. And so stuff that you would absolutely pay attention to out of armor, you simply ignore in armor and you go in for the target because you can't.
Yes.
But a horse.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I think it's maybe then.
An armored horse is going to behave the same. Sorry.
Yeah. So how much does a complete bard weigh?
Oh, now that's a great question. I don't know is the short answer.
Okay.
Would very much depend on the materials that are being used. So obviously a steel bard is going to weigh considerably more than a quilted textile caparison. So this sort of looks very much like a horse blanket, but can be, you know, can almost go down
it's
to
defensive.
The hooves, if you like. Yeah. It does have some defensive qualities. Yeah. That's going to weigh less than a male trapper, so a male body protection for the horse.
Okay, so what attracted you to horse armor particularly? Because I mean, I've been to the armory more than once, and there are suits of armor there that I would happily take home with me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The curators wouldn't let me, unfortunately. Like, no, we can't just lend it to you for the next 5 years for research purposes, guy. No, you have to leave it in the case, I'm afraid. Of all the stuff you have to look at in that armory, you know, from there's rapiers and daggers and there's sabers and there's guns and there's everything.
Mm.
Horse armor is the thing you honed in on.
Mm.
Why particularly?
Oh gosh, there's so many reasons. I think so. I don't ride.
Okay.
I'm not an experienced horse person. But I guess there's a sort of mystery for me in that I don't fully you know, they're still very exciting because it's not something I'm used to doing. So there's that element. But I'm also really interested. I like the decorative. I'm really interested in decorative armor. So I like that this is a much larger canvas to display decoration and decorative techniques in armor. And I enjoy them from a sculptural perspective. I enjoy the horse as... a really important part of the of medieval warfare. So there's a number of reasons, really, and I suppose the kind of cliched romantic things as well of knights in shining armor on horseback.
Okay, so what sort of like sculpture and decoration are we seeing on horses? What's your favorite bit of like decorative horse armor?
Okay, so picking a favorite. Let's see. So there's the Gothic armor. We have a Gothic armor at the armories. It's and it's on open display. So it's horse mannequin in armor, and the knight in armor. And it's the horse armor is one of the one of only a handful of full horse bards of that period. It's late 15th century, and it's embossed to take on very Gothic and grotesque features. So it has an embossed grotesque face on the petrol. The chaffron protecting the horse's face has been sort of exaggerated in certain elements, so it looks a little bit like a dragon. The tail of the horse flows from the mouth of a little basilisk that sits on the horse's rump. So it's very kind of monstrous and mythical and magical. You know, it's really feeding into this idea of awe-inspiring on the battlefield and the tournament field.
Wow.
But we see all kinds of decorative techniques. All the decorative techniques that have been used on armor are being used on horse armor. Just on a, you know, it's just a much larger surface. So engraving, etching, gilding, bluing, with leather armors, they can be painted. With textile caparisons, they can be embroidered. And yes, it's a lovely creative space.
Okay. Now we're going to have to get pictures of that armor, stick them
in
the show notes.
Yes, absolutely.
Can you send me some photographs I can stick in the show notes?
I certainly can, yes. Yeah, it's an impressive display.
I think the average listener is going to want to actually see that, the details. Yes. That'd be fantastic. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, have you been to the Stibbet Museum in Florence?
No, I haven't, but it's definitely on
the cavalcade there. Yeah. Is absolutely gobsmacking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've heard great things.
And there are similarly impressive moments in Leeds too. So just you get a sense of looking up at this armored horse with the armored knight on top of it. You really don't want to get too close.
Yeah, that's it. It's the awe that it inspires. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, now I have done a little bit of research. I sort of cyberstalk all of my guests because that's part of the job. So I think you'll understand the phrasing of this question. What is so strapping about that particular pair of stirrups?
Yeah. Okay. So
what are we talking about?
Yeah. So we're talking about a pair of two pairs of presentation stirrups that I wrote an article for in the Field magazine, and it is these stirrups are interesting for a number of stories that they tell us. So strapping. A strapping set of stirrups essentially refers to the decoration on these stirrups. Mm-hmm. So there's the two pairs of decorative presentation stirrups, and they are associated with Henry Lowther, the third Earl of Lonsdale, and they were made around 1830.
They're quite modern,
yes.
Okay.
But what's interesting about them is that they are mimicking a style that is much earlier, so sort of 15th and 16th and 17th century stirrups. So they have a twisted bars to form the tread, and I'll send you images of these so your listeners can have a really good look at them. So they have twisted bars that make up the tread. They've got quite a broad arch, and they have this engraved decorative strap work on the arch. And these the strap work on these stirrups is very similar to the kind of decoration we see on armors that are produced in the Royal Greenwich Workshop, which was established by Henry VIII in 1515. And they are very similar to a pair of stirrups that belong to an armor at the Wallace Collection, which belonged to Sir Thomas Sackville, Lord Buckhurst. The whole of the armour is decorated with this beautiful ribboned strap work, and that's almost identical to what we're seeing on these 19th century stirrups. So they're a much more modern piece of equipment. They presentation stirrups. The Lowthers were very well-known horse into sports, notable sports person. They were involved in the hunt, that kind of thing. But they're very much reaching back to these earlier styles, and I just find that really interesting that they do that.
So do you think they were deliberately modelled on those stirrups?
I think so. I mean, they're very consciously similar to the stirrups of the Buckhurst armour.
But do we know where the Buckhurst armour was in the early 19th century?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't actually. I don't know when the Wallace acquired it, so that is a really.
I remember Wallace is a bit later than that, if I remember rightly. So I don't think I don't think the Wallace Collection had even begun then.
Mm.
So I'm just I mean, probably it was in Sackville Hall or Buckhurst Hall or something like that. Before it got snapped up in an estate sale. But it's just, it's interesting to, because when you see these kind of copyings, it's nice to be able to prove that the person who you think has copied actually had access to the thing that you think they copied.
Yes, yes. And this is one of the many frustrating things, is that there's just so much we don't know, and we don't know who made the presentation stirrups, the 19th century presentation stirrups. So
what were they for, the stirrups? I mean, obviously, you put your feet in them when you're riding a horse, but these are like presentation stirrups, which are probably not just used for, like, you know, going hacking in the countryside.
Yeah, so they will have been, they're probably given to, perhaps for an event. Again, we don't know the circumstances of their presentation to Henry Lowther, but they were still practical stirrups, so they may have been used. They may have been displayed, they may have been used. I don't know.
Okay, fair enough. and that is often the case with this historical business. It's like, well, it might be this, it might be that, but there's no real way to know because we haven't got the information.
Yeah.
So aside from the armor, what is your favorite thing in Leeds Armoury?
Oh, that's not armor.
Mm.
Oh. Wow, okay. Great.
I mean, we talked about armor for the last half an hour, and we also like swords on this show, but honestly, you know, guns and bows and all sorts of other ways of murdering people are also popular. So anything else that grabs your attention when you come in?
Yeah, there's lots of things, really. I mean, favorite objects for me, it really depends on my mood. Okay. So I do like decorative, the more decorative pieces. Oh, gosh. Favourite object that's not armour. Ooh, to think about that.
Okay.
There's too many. Pick just one.
That's the problem. See, I have this rule when I'm going to a large collection like the Royal Armouries or, I don't know, the Prado in Madrid or the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York or wherever. Because I love museums, obviously. If you try and just go and see everything, you end up kind of seeing nothing because it's just a massive overwhelm. And when you've seen 1,000 objects in the last hour and a half, they all just mix together and you're done. So what I do is I pick one or two things that I go there to see. So for example, in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, it might be the Studiolo of the Duke of Urbino, which is this incredible little room which has all this marquetry on the walls, Trompe-l'oeil marquetry everywhere. Mm. And it's just stunning. And of course, and that was Federico, I should know this, because his son, Guidobaldo, was the dedicatee of a treatise on martial arts by a chap called Philip Abadi. So there's a kind of actual practical sword connection there. Going to the Kelvin Grove, the thing that I always go to see first, and if I've seen that, then I've seen the Kelvin Grove, is the Avant armor. And after that is the Spitfire.
Okay.
Right? And then things like, you know, the Arms and Armor Gallery, there's a million different cool things, blah, blah, blah. But if you just kind of show up to a museum like the Kelvin Grove or like the Royal Armouries just to kind of see stuff, you will see everything, but you won't remember anything. From your perspective, if people listening were going to visit the Royal Armouries, what like top two or three things in the kind of medieval combat area? Mm. So you can restrict it time wise if you like. Yeah. What would you suggest that they come and see?
Okay. It's armor. You see, I've obviously got.
Okay, fine.
We have a beautiful bassinet that's on display in the War Gallery, about 1390, and it is one of the finest examples, I believe, surviving, and it's displayed next to a great helm, so it's quite nice. You can see the development. But it's in amazing condition, and it has its original Avantail. And yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful object. And right next to that is the cruciform display, which has all the horses.
Okay.
So, and then within there, we have some really impressive armors as well. So the armor of, oh gosh, now I'm going to forget his name. The Earl of Southampton. So a later armor, which has this really beautiful etched decoration all over it. It's got butterflies and dragonflies and snails with wings and all kinds of whimsical squirrels with huge tufty ears. And that one's a really beautiful later armor, that one. So yeah, but there's so much. It's so difficult. I mean,
yeah. Okay. But somebody coming to the museum, I want to see the armor with the squirrels with big tufty ears. We'll get them in the right place, and then they see that, and they'll remember it, and they'll absorb it, and then they maybe go and see the bassinet.
Yeah.
And go, oh my god, because rather than looking at a whole like suit of armor, they have a look at just one particular piece, and then from there. Follow their interests around the place, and because it is a huge mistake to try and see everything, I think.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah.
You don't see anything. Mm. Okay, so I have a couple of questions that I ask almost all of my guests, because, you know, as you know, my guests get the chance to check the questions, and some people just decline to answer certain questions, and that's fine, that's entirely within their rights. So most guests get asked this question. What is the best idea you haven't acted on yet?
Such a great question. Oh, dear. The best idea I haven't acted on. So I don't think I have really great ideas that often, you know.
Really?
This time of year, it always gets me thinking about the things I'd like to do but probably won't do related to some harebrained New Year's scheme. And that gets me thinking about the things I wanted to do but didn't do this year. And one thing that I had really hoped to do this year was to start sketching arms and armour more. Actually to start sketching arms and armour, because I don't. And I just think it's such a useful tool, and I don't think many people do it that much anymore, because, you know, you can just whip out your smartphone and take an accurate picture of something to remember. But I've got this romantic idea of filling a sketchbook with, Jura-esque style.
honestly, like the way you have to look at something to draw it, it's kind of like the way you have to think about something to write about it.
Absolutely.
It's entirely different to pulling out your phone and going click.
It absolutely is. You're absolutely right. And you're going to, if you're having to draw the proportions of something, the form, the shape, you're absolutely going to see it differently. And I wish it's something I'd started doing got into this.
I have a question then. Why don't you do it?
Oh, gosh, I'm absolutely terrible at sketching. Terrible. It would look like a disparate and out of proportion My Little Pony.
Okay. All right. But I know a little bit about how people develop skill, because I teach people skills as my job. And it is entirely normal for the first, I don't know, 100 hours or 500 hours or whatever of doing an activity for you to completely suck at it. That's entirely normal. Like, both of my daughters draw really well. And the reason they draw really well is because they started out drawing incredibly badly when they were very, very little. And they just never stopped. Right? And it's not that they have some kind of massive artistic talent or anything. Of course, I mean, they're my children. I think they're massively gifted at all sorts of things. But objectively speaking, they weren't drawing like Da Vinci when they were three. But they draw extremely well as teenagers, because they've spent hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours drawing.
Mm.
Right? So it's a bit like when people are trying to write a book and they can't write a book because the thing that they're writing is obviously shit. Right? And the reason it's shit is because they've never written anything before, so they don't know how to do it. And so it's going to be shit. Mm. And that's fine. This is normal. You start with the shit first draft and then you maybe throw it away and write another shit first draft, and maybe throw that one away and write another shit first draft. And that one's actually good enough that it's worth a bit of editing. And eventually, in my case, 4 years later, you get a book. Right? My first book took me 4 years.
Yeah.
Right? Because there was... And 10% of the first draft ended up in the final book.
Mm.
Right? This is normal. So the way you're going to end up with a notebook full of Dura-like arms and arms studies is if you start sketching like today,
yeah,
and just don't stop, and you know, you don't need to show it to anybody. You shouldn't probably show it to anybody for at least like 6 months of daily practice. Because yes, it will look terrible, and that's fine, but the only way it's ever going to look better is if you practice.
Oh yes, absolutely. Maybe I should start a lunchtime gallery sketching club for myself.
Absolutely. And there are lots of people who go to museums to draw and sketch.
Oh yeah, right? Yeah.
And there are lots of people who can actually teach you how to draw more effectively. So there are like courses and things you can take that will massively speed up the process. But I mean, you're surrounded by all that amazing material. Oh, and you clearly want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll definitely have to, now that I've admitted it to,
right. You've admitted it to like hundreds
to
of people.
To all your listeners.
And they're all over the place. They're in like South Africa and New Zealand and Australia and Chile and, you know, Canada and all over the place. Right.
I'm going to be held accountable now.
Yeah, yeah. So okay, I have a challenge should you choose to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? No pressure whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And we can always snip this bit out later. Right. Okay. A year from now,
mm-hmm.
I'd like you to send me a sketch to put in the show notes.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, okay.
And if... you've been practicing a lot, it'll be quite good. Probably.
Okay, I accept that challenge.
And obviously, you know, if you're looking to go, actually, no, I want to leave it another year, we can possibly renegotiate. but a year from now, today is the 28th of November, right? Which is 2 days before my birthday, so I will not forget. So for my birthday next year, right, I expect a sketch of anything armor related.
Okay. I'm yes. Okay. I think that sounds like a very enjoyable
exactly.
challenge. Yeah. Okay.
And I would suggest you get a bit of like A4 paper, fold it into four, keep it in your pocket with a stub of pencil.
Mm.
Right. So you don't need a big fancy sketchbook or like hand bound gorgeous leather thing, which if you start drawing in it, you think you're going to just ruin it. Right? Start out with just scraps of paper, back of an envelope, whatever.
Yeah.
Because you're just going to sketch it and it's probably going to be a bit crap, so you throw it away.
Yeah. And right? the fear of a beautiful new notebook, you do get the paralysis associated with that, don't you?
Right.
Yeah.
And then maybe like in a year's time when actually they're quite good, right?
Mm.
Maybe get yourself a nice notebook because now it feels like the sketching is...
Yeah. Okay.
I sketch when I'm talking to people.
Oh, because, brilliant! Yeah.
It keeps bits of my brain.
Yes. It's a great tool.
Yeah, I pay better attention if I'm also doodling knife designs.
Yes. Yeah. There is definitely something to be said for that. I'm quite similar actually, particularly when listening to lectures and things that. You know, doodling. Well, now my doodling has purpose.
Yes, there you go. There you go. And actually, I have a question for you. What have I just drawn?
You've drawn a frog mouth helm.
I have drawn a frog mouth helm. Now, my drawing skills are shit, right? I don't know, that's pretty good. But even you could recognize that what I've just drawn is a frog mouth helm. There we go. So yeah. If I can do it, you can do it.
Okay, sure. So 28th of November 2024, I will send you a sketch, and if it's of a decent quality, I will treat myself to a sketchbook.
Excellent. And we'll put that sketch in the show notes.
Okay.
Because people come in and listen to stuff from you know, in a year's time, people like they go back and they find all the episodes and stuff. When it's on the internet, it's kind of forever. No pressure.
Oh, dear.
Okay. All right. My last question. Mm-hmm. Somebody gives you £1 million or similarly large amount of imaginary money to spend improving. I mean, I usually put historical martial arts in the question, but you know, public's understanding of the importance of horse armor could be a reasonable adjustment to it or whatever. How would you spend the money to improve the understanding of your field?
Yeah, how exciting. So at the risk of repeating what Natasha said when she had when you had her a chat with her, digitization. Absolutely. Okay. Digitization of collections, digitization of archives, of resources. And as you will know all too well through your own extensive research, Guy, that the kinds of materials that we look at are only so, you know, they can be limiting. They only tell us so much when they're sort of standalone. And digitization, pouring a load of money into digitization would really enable the, would really facilitate more access to this material. And that's just such an integral part of what we do and what we're interested in. You know, if we have, when we're cataloguing objects at the museum and we're updating records and we're updating research, a huge part of that is to try and situate an object within as many parts of its different stories and its different histories as we can know. So, you know, not just what is it, what does it do, who owned it, but why is this important, and where can I find more information about it, and why should I be bothered by it?
Right.
So, I mean, all that kind of thing. So, it's kind of like a thread, a web, isn't it, to use another cliche, that everybody interested in the field of arms and armour and in historical martial arts and jousting and horses and all that kind of thing, it's all contributing to this giant web, but some parts of the web of, you know, they're really intricate and they've got loads of, it's quite a solid ground, but other parts are just falling apart because there's so many areas that we don't know. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, it's so helpful when cataloguing an object to be able to look on another institution's collections online and see, other similar objects, and where have they looked for information, and where have theirs come from, and
also just so specifications useful. Very helpful, measurements of things. So it's not just taking the pictures.
Also,
how much it weighs, where its point of balance is, if it's a sword. The dimensions of it, so that you can reproduce a copy of it, and test it to destruction without doing any harm at all to the original object.
Absolutely. So, all the different aspects of an object. So, images are great, but describing things, might spark somebody's understanding of something, or memory of something else. You know, writing down all the maker's marks and describing those, and the weights and measurements, and all that kind of thing. Yeah.
So what objects would you start with?
Oh, horse armor.
Horse armor. Yeah, fair. No. There is not enough digitized horse armor on the internet. That is fair.
Yeah. So at the moment, I'm working on trying to digitize as much of the horse armor collection at the armories as possible. So
how do you do it?
So it mainly takes the form of cataloging. So when we update our catalog entries, part of that is making those available online through our collections online webpage. So we take, we very much build on the hard work and research of our predecessors, and we input that to make it available online so that it's not necessarily just paper records, you know, hold up here. We add any information that we can. We look at it with fresh eyes. We check we can fill in as much, any basically our catalogue entries. We're always working to ensure that what the visitor can see on our collections online page is probably as much information as we know on that object, so that the visitor can have can know everything that we know about it.
Are you also doing like 3D imaging where you're taking lots and lots of photographs and creating this kind of composite thing that you can turn around?
We sometimes have projects like that. So I think Natasha will have taught you about the Sikh Museums initiative, that kind of thing. Our photography involves professional photography, but not always 3D 3D stuff, although that, I mean, that would be amazing, wouldn't it?
Let's
put some of the £1 million into that.
How about this? 3D printing programs.
Oh, yeah.
So that you can imagine if you could just print out a chaffron.
Amazing. Amazing.
And then you could
Like,
that would be so cool.
It would be so cool. And then you could have that, you know, 360 dynamic.
Yeah, and again, it's something you printed out yesterday. So if you drop it and break it, it doesn't matter. You can you can do all sorts of stuff to it that is not going to damage your
original. Trial different things. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, a great part of making these things accessible online in particular is that it means more people can come to us and say, oh, have you seen this? And did you know about this? So if, you know, we might have an object where we know of 5 known other examples of this type of sword, for example, and then we will try and list all those examples where we know them. And then we might get somebody contact us and say, oh, I remember seeing one at so-and-so museum in such a place. Great. We've now got a handful plus one. So it's really, I feel quite strongly about my role in terms of facilitating access to this material, and that and empowering other people to be able to interpret this material, because all, you know, that of course the outcome of that is that we're collectively going to understand it more.
Yeah, get as many different minds as possible on the problem, including minds that don't happen to have the time, money, or leisure to go to Leeds and spend 3 weeks in your basement.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I do have the time, money, and leisure to spend 3 weeks in your basement anytime. Just saying.
noted. Yeah, but and we do lots of, you know, there's the cataloging element, but also digitizing in terms of digitizing lectures, having online talks, putting thoughts and ideas and research into blog posts and podcasts, and, you know, so it's all part of the same, isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the functions of this podcast. It gets people to hear from all sorts of people who they might not otherwise have access to.
Yes.
Like, the average person can't just ring you up and say, Ellie, tell me all about horse armor. Right? I mean, it would be unwise to just put your phone number on the internet and say, by all means, ring me anytime for an hour-long chat about horse armor.
That
would
be
not
nice,
be a
wouldn't
be a sensible...
I'd enjoy that.
No, really not. At all. So thanks so much for joining me today, Ellie. It's been lovely to meet you.
Thank you so much, Guy. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Ellie. You can find the episode show notes at swordschool.com/podcast. And yes, it does include pictures of that fabulous armor. And you will find transcriptions, photos, videos, and links for this episode. While you are there, you can sign up for my mailing list, and I'll send you a free copy of my Sword Persons Care Package. This includes 4 ebooks and access to several of my online courses. Remember, go to swordschool.shop to get From Your Head to Their Hands, How to Write, Publish and Market Training Manuals for Historical Martial Artists. That's the book I launched a couple of weeks ago, and if you haven't got it already, I think you jolly well should. I'd like to thank the people who make this show possible, my patrons on Patreon. It takes time and money to run a podcast, and without them, I would have given up a long time ago. You can join us at patreon.com/theswordguy for behind-the-scenes content, to suggest future guests, and priority access to my inbox. That's patreon.com/theswordguy. And as always, I'd like to thank Andrew Lawrence King for the Baroque harp accents that adorn the show, originally recorded for my Paradoxes of Defense audiobook project. Join us next time when I'll be talking to Dario Alberto Magnani, better known as Mr. Thok. He is a longtime scholar of the Italian single combat tradition from the late medieval and early Renaissance period, and a world-renowned historical martial arts instructor and gear designer. He is probably best known for his Thok gloves, which are a synthetic sparring glove, which are probably the highest quality such things you can get on the market today. Yes, we do talk quite a bit about how he created these gloves and how he created the business that actually creates the gloves, because it's fascinating stuff. But we also go into incredibly geeky depth and detail about a specific passage from Fiori de Liberi's Il Fiore di Battaglia. Yes, we geek on and on and on for some 2 hours about one paragraph. Now, if that sounds like your sort of thing, like, what exactly does tornare mean and how do we know what it means? Then the next episode is absolutely going to be for you. So it's a very geeky conversation. I do hope you enjoy it. I certainly enjoyed it. It's a continuation of a very long conversation we had at the magnificent Panoplia in Spain in December. And I thought, you know what? I bet a significant proportion of my podcast listeners wish they were listening in to this conversation we were having. Then I thought, well, that can actually be arranged. And so I got Dario onto the show. So we kind of recapped what we chatted about in Spain and then went off into probably the nerdiest territory this podcast has ever been into. I am sure you'll enjoy it. So you don't want to miss that. Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcast from. And if you have an extra minute, do leave a review. And of course, if you've enjoyed this episode particularly, do tell your friends. Thanks for listening. I will see you soon.